Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing my exploration of what it means to be a theater director with my interview of Kelly Woodland, who is directing her 98th play, this being Noises Off for the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida. She has a lot to say about directing and what it means to be a theater person. So hang on, here come the show.
Inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
The Lynn Show is all about knowing yourself and being yourself. This doesn't seem like such a complicated or difficult thing when I say it, but I know it to be a difficult and complicated thing for many of us. I know because as a psychotherapist, I have seen over and over again the dilemma that people face when they come into therapy saying, I don't want to do this anymore, I don't want to be this anymore, or I need to develop this skill. It's my life is damaged, is limited by the fact that I can't assert myself, that I can't ask for help, that I can't stop working so hard, that I can't accept the love of others, that I can't believe in myself. Any of these things. And my finding over and over again that this quality of assertiveness or self-love or the ability to accept help actually already exists within the person, but they can't get at it. They can't access it. They are in denial for it. So how do I discover that this quality is in a person who comes into therapy with me? And understand here that I'm dividing the problem of recognizing that it is actually already there from accessing it and making use of it. That's a separate problem, which I may get to today as I have a little time, but I'm going to focus on the discovery aspect. So somebody comes to me and says, I've always been shy. Whenever I need to, or I want to, get something for myself. Let's say I've been working at this job for a very long time, and I believe that I do a good job. They tell me, they seem very happy with me, but I'm not getting a raise or I'm not getting a promotion, and I really want to ask for it, or at least find out if I'm not going to get it. Maybe I don't want to stay here anymore, but I can't make my mouth ask for it. I get tongue-tied, my heart starts to pound, or I get nauseous. I can't make myself ask for what I want and what I believe I deserve. Of course, this doesn't only show up in relationship to work. Quite often, relationships. My friend is always teasing me, always making me the butt of her jokes. You know, we've been friends forever, and she's always done this, and I really don't like it. But I don't know how to tell her. I don't want to hurt her feelings. I don't want to make her feel bad. But I feel bad, and I don't know how to get her to stop. You know, my wife tells these stories about me that are embarrassing to me in public. And, you know, I tried to say something about it, but she just laughed and said, oh, don't be silly, nobody thinks less of you. But I think less, and I want it to stop, but I can't tell her. Again, usually you hear, I don't want to hurt her feelings, I don't want to embarrass her. So I don't know what to do, because I am not able to stand up for myself. I'm aware of this in lots of areas of my life, but I don't know what to do about it. So how would I go about helping such a person find that quality? Well, I have developed a little tool, a little game, even a little exercise called the family pie. It's very simple. It's very easy, although sometimes people have difficulty with it, but I'll explain why that is. Well, I think it'll be self-evident. You just take a piece of paper and you draw a big circle on the piece of paper. And you divide the circle into as many pieces as there were people in your family of origin. So there's mom and dad and my sister and my brother and me, or my three brothers and me, or my two sisters, my mother, and you know. And if someone lived with you, grandma lived with you, or Aunt Susie lived with you, maybe you want to put them in as well. So you have three pieces in your pie. If you're an only child, you have four or five or seven, it doesn't actually matter. And then you take each one of these pieces one at a time, and you write the qualities that you believe that that person has. Mom is hardworking, she's a caretaker, she's very funny, she's a saver, she saves a lot of money, she always, you know, is stuffing money in a drawer or something. Dad is gruff, and he's hard to get to know. He's kind of aloof. My sister is, you know, boy crazy. All she wants to talk about is boys, and she you can't get her to do any of the chores. She's really lazy, and no matter what anybody says to her, she just says, "Sure, later, whatever." Oh, right. My brother is the serious one in the family. He takes everything to heart. He gets his feelings hurt. He's really sensitive. And then you put in the qualities for you. Now, obviously, I made these qualities up, right? They are some of the qualities that show up in family pies. Where's that family's pie? Well, they are some of the qualities that show up. So you do this, and sometimes people have a little difficulty with it. I can't describe myself. I don't know. Well, you can start off with the quality that you came in here to talk about. Shyness, difficulty in asserting, sensitivity to hurting other people's feelings. You know some stuff about yourself. And maybe that will prime the pump and you can think of some other things about yourself. Maybe you have a really good sense of humor, although you very rarely tell jokes because you're shy. Or maybe you're the serious one in the family and you're the sensitive one and you're always getting your feelings hurt. Or maybe you're the dreamer and you have all these ideas and fantasies which you can't actually act on and people tease you about them. Or maybe you're the overweight one in your family and everybody's always on you to eat less and to exercise and you don't want to. I don't know. Again, these are all the kinds of things that come up when people are describing themselves and the members of their family. So then I ask the person, after they have done their family pie, to again describe the quality that they want to have. And in this case, we're using shyness or the difficulty asserting oneself. And then I ask them to look at their family pie and see if anyone else in the family has that quality. Inevitably, somebody has that quality. Sometimes everybody else has that quality except this one individual. Well, I believe, and this is the gospel according to Lynn, you don't have to believe me, you don't have to agree with me. You can change the channel. But I believe that whatever qualities exist in any member of the family exists in every member of the family, that these qualities belong to the system. They're in everyone. However, we get assigned qualities, and everyone doesn't get assigned everything. In fact, often we get assigned opposites. So if you are shy and hypersensitive and unwilling to assert yourself, I am willing to bet that there's somebody in the system who is blunt and always able to ask for what they want and not shy and right out there and direct. And again, sometimes everyone in the system has a quality that is opposite from you, that you're the one who is demonstrating, who's been assigned the opposite quality. Or maybe all the girls in the system have it, and all the boys have something else. Or maybe you and mom have it, and the rest of the family has the opposite. And I could talk more about why that might happen, but for the moment, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you ask yourself, having done the family pie, is there a quality I am yearning for, wish I had, feel bad that I don't have? Is there some way in which I believe my life would be better if I could do something that I can't now do, or if I could stop doing something? You know, I am overweight. I'd like to lose weight, but I can't stop myself from eating, even when I'm not hungry. So is there somebody in your family who doesn't have any problem with that, who's thin and who can controls their weight easily, or is an exercise fanatic, or So you look at this, and really the only significant point I want to make today is that if what you are trying to achieve, either to develop or to undevelop, to stop, if it exists in the system, someone else has it, you have it. You have a very, very good reason for being in denial for it, and it won't be easy to get access to. Remember earlier I said that's an entirely separate thing. Simply knowing that it's there is not going to do it. Well, maybe it will do it for you. If you do your family pie and you say, wow, my sister is the most inventive person I know, and she's got all these great ideas, and everything turns into an idea for her, and I can't think of a thing. And then you say to yourself, well, Lynn said, if she can do it, I can do it, and then you can do it, well, hey, more power to you. And please email me. Oh, maybe this is a good time to give my website. TheLynnShow.com, TheLynnShow.com, TheLynnShow.com. Don't forget the E in Lynn. So you can email me to tell me, well, I saw that and I could access it right away, or I saw it and I haven't got a clue how to access it, or I didn't see it and I don't know what you're talking about, or anything that you might want to tell me about what you can make of my talking about the family pie today. I can tell you that this information about the family pie is in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can also learn about the book on my website, thelynnshow.com. You can click, obviously, on Contact Me to contact me. You can buy the book. You can listen to the first chapter. You can get the workbook or the audiobook. Although I am very behind in getting out audiobooks, I'm sorry. Or you can talk to me about psychotherapy on the go, since I do all my psychotherapy these days on the telephone, and there's an article on the website called Psychotherapy on the Go, where you can read about what it's like to do phone therapy. In any case, well, and also, there are other podcasts where I talk about the family pie, and hopefully sometime in the near future, I will talk about what you do to access it once you have discovered it, or at the very least, one of some of the reasons that make it difficult to access. But now I'm going to introduce the second half of the show, the second part of the show, which is the series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. If you've been listening to the show, you know that I have been almost exclusively interviewing directors who are directing shows that are ongoing at the many theaters in Sarasota, Florida. Today is no exception. Today I am interviewing one of the few female directors, and the only director, as she says, who's directing in Sarasota, who has directed and is directing in this one season at every community theater in Sarasota and Venice and in Vierns. That's quite a feather. And she's about to have her direction of the hilarious comedy Noises Off on stage at the Players Theater in Sarasota, in fact, March 22nd. And this is her 98th directing experience. So lots to be learned from Kelly Woodland, and not only lots to be learned, but she's charming and adorable. And so here, in her own words, Kelly Woodland. Okay, I'm here with Kelly Woodland in my kitchen. She was kind enough to come all the way over here after work. I'm so grateful. And Kelly is currently directing Noises Off for the Players Theater in Sarasota, Florida, which will be opening March 22nd?
Yes, March 22nd.
Yes, great. Okay. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
That would be me.
Yes, yes. I know that that's true. And I only ask one question, and that is, how did it get started? I'm assuming that the art that we're talking about now is theater.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's never not been there.
I want the beginning.
The very beginning.
I want the moment
that you said or someone said, performer, director, talk a lot, tiny, very gregarious child.
Yes.
Please get out from under my feet and do something productive. That would be my mother.
Something productive as opposed to...
Do a play. Well, my mother was an art major in elementary education. She majored in art, and also she was a dancer and was very involved in the arts. And she got me to doing plays. I always was the one organizing the neighborhood show.
About 7, 8, 9?
The first actual play that I was in, I was 6.
6?
Yeah, I played Mustard Seed in A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. My God, starting at the top.
To a little child, Shakespeare's easy. It is, because I believed everyone talked that way.
Oh, how amazing. Did you have much of a part?
Too much dialogue? Not a lot. Has a little scene with Puck, and a few lines here and there.
Wow!
On the stage a lot.
How did that happen?
My cousins were involved in theater in Atlanta, and literally my mother wanted me out of the house, and so hey, go with your cousins, and they said, hey, this child talks a lot. Get on stage.
So, really?
Yeah, that's exactly true. And so it was a nerd kid's paradise, you get the opportunity to pretend, and I pretend, I can never remember any time I wasn't pretending an alternate universe of some kind.
Really?
And that you get to do it.
So did you do that before this play? I mean,
all the time. I think all little kids do, but I was always writing plays and making up things.
Even really little?
Really little, as far as I can remember.
Okay, so you go to the cousins and they say, this kid talks a lot, let's put her on stage.
Well, they were involved in a Shakespeare company that was in Atlanta, and they and their friends were, and they were casting small children. And it's a tough, I can tell you from experience now, it's a tough thing to do to get a small child that can
do it.
Speak and not run amok.
Yeah. Yeah, no, really. Who can take direction?
Right, who can take direction. And I thought I was a grown-up.
Do you remember the experience?
Very, very clearly. Completely. Absolutely. And I played, and then pretty soon after that, I was Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker.
Pretty soon after 6?
I was 8. Well, Helen, she's a little girl, so I was 8.
Helen Keller, not the...
Yeah,
right.
Not Annie.
Not Annie, right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I got confused.
No, I've never been privileged to play Annie. I would love to.
Well, but Helen Keller's a very tough role.
It kind of is, and it kind of isn't. It's when you're a child, maybe not all children, but a lot of children... so readily,
right?
They just project themselves into a fictional situation,
right?
And I did.
And there's not a lot of lines.
Well, I see very badly.
Anyway,
really badly too. Right. So it was just that was pretty darn fun.
So are you saying you were seeing pretty badly even as a young
girl? Oh yeah,
yeah. So good eyesight.
And that was I had a wonderful director who was able to. Who was able to just say, hey, do this, and a great cast, and it was easy. I mean, it was easy, and it was fun, and you get to be around a variety of people, so I grew up in that environment.
And that was not in Atlanta with that
back home? That was in Atlanta also.
Oh, yeah. So you...
I did that just as a small child, and then there was a big gap in between where I just did now and again in school. But once you get bit, once you're bitten, that's it, you're done. And I found out, I had studied the piano, and everything was music and art, and in high school, we organized theater club, we wrote things, we directed things, and they were terrible. but we didn't think so.
No, and it was fun.
And I did some community theater at that time as well. And got cast, auditioned for some things, and got cast in musicals because I was a little soprano. Mm-hmm. And so I got to play Louisa like 90 gazillion gazillion times. Went to Manatee Junior College at that time, tells you how old I am, and majored in theater there and met wonderful people, worked with an amazing department there that taught me discipline, that like theater discipline.
Ah.
And went to Florida State and majored in theater. And did along the way did some regional musicals.
So you majored in theater.
Mm-hmm. I majored in theater and education double major.
Ah,
because my father said you will do something that you can support yourself, and he was very smart to do that. But when I got out of school, when I got out of Florida State, I went right into teaching to support myself. And got a master's degree then and decided to do directing instead of acting. So I went into, I got a master's degree in directing. I had played Louisa enough times at that point. And I've always been kind of a tomboy and definitely like a sci-fi geek and that sort of thing. And I just couldn't do cute anymore.
Yeah.
That was just it. Yeah. No more cute.
Right.
And I had done Shakespeare as a child and I wanted to do more of that.
So. Right. You wanted to do serious.
Yes. Serious and dark.
Really?
I wanted to do something with more bite to it, you know. And that happened very quickly. Very quickly.
Are we talking about as an actor or as a director?
As an actor too, but directing paid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how interesting.
So that it was, I had a little baby at that time, and I really needed the money.
Right.
But also, it seemed like just a natural thing, because I naturally was always thinking of how that would look to me. Mm-hmm. And it really always was something that just naturally stepped into.
Right. And you got the degree in directing.
I did, yes. Mm-hmm. I did. I got my degree in directing. And started working immediately. I directed some shows at, it was Manatee Community College by that time. I directed some shows there in that department. And I picked up a contract that was dropped by a director moved and dropped a contract and recommended me for that. Mm. And I picked that up, and that was the first time I started directing in this area.
Oh, yeah.
And have never stopped. That was, when was that, 1988, I guess.
Wow. That's a lot. I mean, and very unusual, too. I've been interviewing directors, a lot of directors, this year. And I am interested in the philosophy of directing. What you think of as your philosophy of directing, what it is that you're trying to do, what do you think a director does, what do you think is different about you as a director? Do you mind talking about
that? No, I don't. It is an interesting aspect of it, because not only am I only female director, and I only really just noticed this, I'm the only director of any stripe working at the four main community theaters in Manatee and Sarasota County. I work the Island Players, Manatee Players, and this is in one season, Island Players, Manatee Players, Sarasota Players, in Venice.
Wow.
In one season, which is great.
It's great.
It's really cool.
So talk to me about your philosophy of directing, if you can, if you feel like it, and whether you think there's a difference between men and women as directors.
I think there's a difference between every individual as a director, and in some ways, I think what makes me different as a director is more the fact that I'm also a teacher. And I'm a teacher of eighth graders.
Are you comparing eighth graders to actors?
I am doing exactly that.
Yeah, right.
I have this love of the literature. Mm-hmm. My brain gets up inside of the story. And I love the story. And people always ask me, what's your favorite play? And I said, the one I'm working on right now. Mm-hmm. Because you're in love with it. And it's magic. And to me, I'll spend the whole time absorbed in that magical world. And I think that the function of the director is to use all of the wonderful people at your disposal and all of the media that you can create to shine a light on the heart of that magic that's in that story, to ask questions and to make people think and see. There's a moment, if you swing in a swing, there's a moment at the top where you're weightless. Mm-hmm. And that's the magic in the show right there, that moment. And every audience should feel that. And you should be able to sit behind them and know when they feel that moment. It may be a comedy, it could be a tragedy, it could be something so strange that they're not sure what it is, but they all have that moment. And to illuminate that.
So do you think you know what that moment is in any given play, or are you...
Eventually you do. I come into it pretty sure I do.
Wow.
We have to, I think. I plan very meticulously ahead of time. And sometimes that's wrong. I mean, sometimes you plan wrong, incorrectly, but it's okay.
I plan very
specifically in pencil. Yes, you have to be very flexible. And that's where I think it helps being a teacher. Mm-hmm. You have ideas. You go in with very, very specific ideas and a knowledge of the feeling and the energy pace that you want from this piece, this living thing. And then you're given the clay. And sometimes it's different clay than you thought.
You're talking about the cast.
The actors,
now,
yes.
Right, yeah.
Right. So you use the strengths of what you've
got.
Yeah,
you use what you've got. Right.
And it becomes at that point an organic process where it grows every moment, every time. From the very first reading of the script, it grows in a different direction. I've been very privileged in my career to work with playwrights with brand new plays. And that's my favorite thing to do.
Well, then you're putting your stamp on it, aren't you?
You're helping it get on its feet. Mm-hmm. It's going to go somewhere on its own eventually. And sometimes that's really hard. Sometimes you're possessive of it.
I'm sure. But what I'm thinking is that you don't have anyone else's work to... that gets in the way.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's virgin to you.
And it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's the greatest, greatest feeling, because you can't really do anything wrong.
No.
You know? you start, you say, I want to do, and then you can do anything you want to. I had the greatest, do you mind if I mention specific pieces?
Not at all.
I had the greatest privilege, I don't know if you know Ron Myrup. Mm-hmm. I worked with him in Venice, and he's a playwright and a director and an actor, a very talented man. But he wrote a play called In the Lap of the Gods. And it had been in readings, but we did the fully staged production of it. And it's very abstract in some ways, piece, very metaphorical. But the great thing was sitting down with the production company, and you can do anything.
Right.
You can do anything. You can make the set look like anything you want. You can...
There's no Bible.
There's nothing.
Right.
You know, there's words. There's not even really... When you get the first manuscript, there's really not stage directions at all. So, ta-da! And that is so much fun. And you play around with things, and you'll do things, and wow, that was terrible.
Yeah, well, let's not do that.
No, never do that again. Right, ever, right, ever.
And was the playwright involved? I assume he was.
Yes,
right.
He was.
So it's a real...
I ran him off at one point. Because sometimes playwrights hate to admit, I will admit I cannot write plays, or I'm way too insecure about writing, about me writing, because I respect the playwrights too much. But there's a point sometimes where a playwright can't see the play anymore. They are very much, it's very much them and they are it. They don't see how it lives in the world.
I'm just curious, did you read Act One, Moss Hart's autobiography?
Oh, yes. Moss Hart, yeah.
Yeah, he talks about Once in a Lifetime, his first play, and getting how it got on to Broadway. And he makes this very point, although I don't think he actually says it in that way, but they rewrite it three times. The first time, only the first act works. And the second time, only the first two acts work. And they can't get the third act right. They can't get it right. They can't get it right, you know. And it's that thing that they were too close to it to see why the audience didn't like it or why it didn't work, you know. And then finally they got it right and the rest is history. But it's an amazing process. Mm-hmm. It's a stunning and just incredibly enthralling process. But it really, you really do have to say, give me the baby.
Yes.
And I will teach it to walk.
Right. You know? Right. And you can come back when
and
it's on.
And you come back and we will sing for you.
Right.
You
know? Right.
So,
right.
So it's a great time.
But it's a real collaboration.
It is. It is. And then the player will say, well, I can't live without this. And it's all right, well, we can make this work, but you need to come at it this way.
Right, right.
Because the actors are making it. And the actors do, they put themselves into it. So when it starts to walk and talk, it changes. You know?
Yes.
And then it becomes a teenager and you hate it. You know? And you're like, oh, I will kill it now. And then you have to put it away for a while.
So some of the stuff you're saying about the magic moment and that, is that part of your training or did you come to that on your own? Do you know?
A little bit of training because you read all of the so many brilliant people who have gone before and all the ways they approach it. But to be honest with you, sitting in an academic situation, you see things in an academic way, or I do. But it isn't until it's like a lot of things. It's not until you actually putting them into practice that you understand what they meant.
Yes. Oh yeah.
I get it.
Yeah,
now,
right,
you know,
right.
Okay. You can spout it back for a test. You can do your scene and get your grade or whatever. And then it slowly starts to make sense. By the time I got to doing my thesis performance when I was in grad school, I think things took a jump as far as understanding, but it's really trial and error. And every single show is trial and error. I'm doing Noises Off. This is the second time I've done it, and already I'm seeing things. Oh, I did that wrong last time.
Oh wow!
And we need to do this better this time.
Now is that because you have a cast now that can do what the other ones couldn't? Or
no, it's because I did it wrong.
You just didn't see.
I always say it didn't. It never worked, and I see how it can work better.
Wow.
You know, because the first cast was amazing and they were wonderful. It was a wonderful performance, the first cast I worked with. This is a wonderful cast, but there's some things that when I think back on that first production, I was like, that I didn't care for, you know, and one of the things, especially when you're working with community theater actors is very different than working with professional actors for obvious reasons, but one of the things that I try to get across to them, and I believe this, is if it doesn't work, it's my fault. It's not your fault. If there's something that isn't working, because sometimes they're very, very hyper-concerned about, am I doing a good job, which right. Anybody, right. Professional or not. But to me, that inhibits a person. They need a safe place to create. So I believe that it is my fault if it's not working. So I have to figure out how to get what I want or how to communicate what I want. And if there are little moments that just never really gel for me, next time we'll get it better. You know? But
so you're not a perfectionist?
I try to be. I'm going to give you the best show that I possibly can, and we're going to make it, number one, a community theater. We're going to make it the most positive experience for everyone concerned possible, because these people are volunteers.
Yeah, and they're working their ass off, right?
They are. They're donating time, and we're going to make it the most enriching experience that I possibly can.
Wow, this is so interesting to me, because this is a challenge that you don't have in professional theater. You want to make the production, the performance, the play as good as you can make it. You want the audience to be happy, but you don't necessarily, maybe that's not right. It seems to me you are saying, and I think a lot of directors say, you know, you want your actors to have as good of an experience as possible, right?
but it's not the same as with community theater. Am I wrong about that?
Well, different directors have different philosophies, and I get a little prickly with directors that believe. I've worked with a lot of professional cast, and I have the same feeling towards them as I do towards community.
Yeah, the more I talked about it, the less I believed what I was saying.
I heard that.
Yeah.
But there are directors who are brilliant, and they do wonderful work, but they're just mean as heck. Yeah. And I don't stand by that.
I interviewed a director the other day who was saying that he also did not stand by that, and that he knows directors who say that they believe that the actors need to be afraid of them.
I don't see how that could be productive.
No, I don't
either. In any environment. I mean, no matter where I as an actor am always nervous about, am I getting what I want to get, but I'm not afraid of the director. And there is no director walking and talking I'm afraid of anywhere.
Wow.
I'm concerned about, am I doing justice to this piece as an actor? Because I don't feel as strongly about my talent as an actor as I do as a director. But even in community theater, we're going for a professional product. And I'm pretty pleased with the majority. This is my 98th play. And I'm really pleased with the quality of, I think we go for professional. There are many of them that I would say this could not have been done better anywhere by anybody. But part of that is having been blessed with wonderful actors. This area is rich with talent. Oh, my goodness.
So talk a little bit about Noises Off, about the play.
It's hilarious.
Yes, yes.
I love it. There are two plays that I can think of off the top of my head that I can't even sit and read them over as many times as I have without laughing out loud. Noises Off is one of them, and Dearly Departed is the other one.
I don't know Dearly Departed.
Oh my! Well, it's a Southern play, and it's I've directed that 4 times now. But Noises Off is so funny, and part of it may be that it's so true. I mean, if you've done, it's a little bit like Waiting for Guffman. there's so many things that are so true. And when we're in rehearsal, there's times, last night, the cast got tickled with me because I got laughing so hard that I just put my head down on the table. Because there's characters that are so much like people you've worked with.
Oh, God.
It's very, very, very funny play. And I think that it's extremely tightly written.
Well, my God, imagine he wrote Noises Off and he wrote Copenhagen.
I know.
How could the same person?
What a mind. What a mind.
You know,
really?
Exactly right. What a mind. My God. So, yes.
I find that very sexy.
a good mind?
Yeah.
Yes, well, no, so do I.
Yeah.
So do I.
You got listening, guys.
All right.
It's just a brilliantly constructed play, and it's wonderful. It's so much fun to watch an audience watch it for the first time.
Yeah, they have
no idea what they're getting into.
Right.
And there's so many surprises. I'm afraid to start talking about things because there's so many surprises from the very, very beginning of the play.
It doesn't let up.
It doesn't
let up, right.
It's exhausting.
Yes.
It's exhausting to perform, and it's exhausting to watch because it just never stops. And you think, oh my gosh, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen, and then another act comes along.
Right. I know.
And whew.
So, how long are you running, do you know?
Well, I don't know if we're going to extend another week or not.
Right.
We're scheduled to run the 22nd through March through April the 1st. I suspect we will be extending until the 7th of April because I think it's going to sell very, very well. It's a pretty well-known play.
So does that mean the 7th, if it extended, does that mean there'd be a performance on the 7th?
On the 7th of April. Sometimes they extend to the next Sunday, mm-hmm. but that's Easter, and they're not going to do shows on, they won't, they're not
the
scheduling
shows.
The
next Sunday?
The 8th of April is Easter.
Oh, so this would be Saturday.
Saturday,
say,
April
right,
the 7th would be there
if they extend. Right.
Right.
Okay. So, okay. All right. So, the other question that I ask, well, I always ask, is there anything I didn't ask that I should have?
Do you want to know about, I mean, should I say anything about the plot of it or give a synopsis or anything along those lines?
Give a little.
It's a British theater company, mm-hmm. and they are, in the first act, they are, their final technical rehearsal for a show that they're opening in, on tour called Nothing On. Is the name, see, already I'm just like, and the cast is exhausted and they've been rehearsing all night, and the leading lady is somewhat past her prime, shall we say, but she's invested in a large amount of money in this play as one of the producers, so they're not about to ruffle her feathers, and she can't quite remember what it is she's supposed to do when they open the next day. There's a variety that it comes out that there may be some shall we say shady relations between the director and some of the young ladies in the cast. it's its own little soap opera in this final rehearsal. So they're in rehearsal for this show. Then when you go to the second act, the show's been on tour for a while and things have changed quite a bit. It's a three-act play, so by the third act, they're at the very last production of this play, and the evolution of the relationships between the cast and where the play has gone. Anybody who has ever been in a long run of a show will say, oh my God,
right.
That's it right there.
Tell them what Noises Off means.
Oh, it's the sound, it's a stage direction. Because when something is amiss off stage, in the stage direction, it just says, noises off, which means something goes crash, 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 off stage. It doesn't specify. It's sort of like my favorite Shakespearean stage direction ever. Exit pursued by bear. Yes.
What?
And that's sort of noises off. Could mean a lot of things. In this play, it means a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very fine play.
That's lovely. So, 98 plays. My God. So, I'm thinking, you know, it's not just the actors who are doing double duty, but you're working full-time.
Yes, I am.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, that's a very hectic... No?
It is. Well, it is. It's hard to explain. I get bored easily. And
you're still that little girl.
I don't like to be still.
So this is perfect for you.
It is. It's great. It's wonderful. I'm really thrilled to be able to do it. I teach eighth graders.
What do you teach?
I teach English in a Title I school in Palmetto. I've learned lots of things from these people. They're wonderful. Let's just put it this way, no day is boring.
Lucky you.
I know. Mm-hmm. I feel very fortunate.
And you found two careers that don't allow you very much stillness.
No stillness. Zero stillness. And that's a great, great thing. Once in a while, you do need to... I have dear friends who say, you need a balance. And they are wise. So there's times where you force yourself say, I'm going to be still now.
For at least 10 or 15 minutes.
Right. 2.5 seconds.
Yes, right.
But it's a wonderful thing. I have no complaints. And I'll tell you that the theaters in this area, the people, the staffs of the theater and the people, the artistic directors, are fantastic people.
Yeah.
You mentioned me being the only female director consistently in all the different theaters. They treat me like I'm a queen.
Oh.
It's so great. They listen. They give you what you want. They're just delightful, darling people, and you can't ask for more than that. I think it's just a wonderful thing.
You know, it occurs to me that I said this rather casually, but I want to go back to it. That you found two careers that don't allow for very much stillness, and having said that you're a person that isn't interested in stillness, isn't comfortable with stillness, it seems to me that it's quite extraordinary and wonderful for you that you have found a life that fits you so well.
It's great, and I feel definitely blessed to be able to, was just talking about that today, that to have something that is what I love doing. I mean, if I say to anybody, oh, I have to go to work, I love my job. I love my daytime job. I love my nighttime job. It's the driving between the two is kind of icky.
Yeah.
Because I get sleepy.
Yeah.
But so sometimes I have to learn lines, and I do that when I'm driving. But
learn lines.
Well, some once in a while, in the past couple of years, I've gotten back on the boards, as they say.
Keeping your hand in.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so the other question that I ask is, having given as much life as you have to theater, is there anything that you would say about what it's like to have a life in this art?
It's the most amazing, wonderful thing that you can experience. And I hope that I have the opportunity to draw people into it as much as possible. It's a great sadness that more children at more levels of our society don't have direct exposure to theater, specifically live theater, because I can see that it changes a child's life immediately, regardless of their socioeconomic level, regardless of their language skills. It completely remakes an individual being involved in theater. My daughter grew up I literally carried her into the dressing room in a bucket when she was a bit. There are people out there who say, yes, I've seen that. She's grown up in the theater, and her friends have grown up in the theater, and we try to get young people and everybody, but especially young people, to experience, because it's every world in one world. And you can know the world and you can explore the world within just this one art, which it incorporates all of the arts, and it's wonderful. It's beautiful.
It's a great place to stop.
It is.
Thank you, Kelly.
So there you have it. A woman who is very clearly, dramatically herself. She knows herself so well. She felt her connection, her being bitten by the theater the moment it happened, and never let go. And then became aware that it was directing, not acting. And the minute that she became aware of that, she acted on it. And you hear her talk about her passion for the theater. It's in everything she says, of course, but no less than her passion for teaching. And as she says, she's someone who doesn't like to be still. And so she's created a life that gives her what she wants, the ability to alter the lives of the children in her care, the ability to alter the lives of the casts that she directs, the ability to alter the lives of the audiences that she directs plays for, and her hope that in those audiences are going to be young people who are going to be drawn into the theater. Because, as she says, it enhances lives. So here we have a wonderful example of someone who knows who she is, who advocates for who she is, and who is enjoying the hell out of it. So it is my hope that as you have been listening to Kelly and her, and hearing the story of her evolution into the woman that she is. Not everybody would want this life, but Kelly does, and so she nurtures it and works at it. And I mean, my God, 98 plays. She says, you know, that she talks about how old she is, but I want you to know that she does not look like somebody who could, I don't know how many years it takes to direct 98 plays, but she doesn't look like she can have lived that many years. In any case, I take her word for the fact that she isn't very young, and maybe the self-possession and self-knowledge that you hear from her speaks to how long she's been alive. In any case, it is my hope that you heard the connection, the joy, the passion, and that maybe you are saying to yourself, you know, what kind of a person am I? Am I someone who doesn't like to be still? Or am I someone who loves to do nothing more than lay on the couch, read a book, walk on the beach? Maybe I love the stillness. Who am I? And to hearken back to the beginning of the show, if there's something that you want to be and have not been able to be, or something that you find yourself doing over and over again that you want to stop, please do a family pie. Check it out. Is there that quality, the one you want but have been unable to access, is that in your system? And as I said before, you can go up on my website, thelinshow.com, and click on Contact Me and tell me what you have discovered, whatever it is. So, as always, I need to thank Josh Hackney, without whom there would be no show. And if you need help with computer, with recording, with electronics, you need somebody to build you a computer or fix your computer or, well, any of that stuff, then you want Josh. And, of course, you can get him the way you get me by going up on my website, thelinshow.com. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Maybe you learned something from my discussion about the family pie. Or maybe you learned something about the theater from Kelly that you didn't know. Or maybe you just heard something curious or interesting or something that made you laugh. We certainly did. Anyway, something that'll bring you back. Because, as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear I may have gotten.